This podcast was recorded on Gadigal land. Branch Out would like to acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional owners of this land and all elders past, present and emerging. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. What's your favourite tree? Mine's a salmon gum, the ones that grow in Western Australia. They've got this beautiful, smooth, pink trunk, and they're really tall, so they stand out in the landscape. Our native trees are well adapted to the Australian landscape, but climate change is so complex that even the strongest trees are under threat. The 1st of August 2021 marks National Tree Day in Australia. And so, on Branch Out, we're talking about the future of trees and the ecosystems they live in. I had a virtual catch-up with Andy Lee, Associate Professor in Plant Ecology at the University of Technology, Sydney. She's part of this big collaborative project called Living on the Edge: How Do Australian Plants from Extreme Environments Cope with Extreme Temperatures? With a project this big, my first question had to be, what inspired this research?
Yeah, well, the project actually first came about because my colleague from the Australian National University, Professor Adrian Nicotra, and her research team had been working for many years on cold tolerance in alpine plants. Mm. And my research team had been focusing at the same time in a different universe in Sydney on heat tolerance of desert plants. And a few years ago, we got to chatting about how in these extreme environments, plants can experience swings of over 30 degrees in a single day. Mm. So in a desert, you can get zero overnight. Like say in spring, you might get zero overnight, and then you might get a really, 30 degrees or even more. So you can have these extreme swings in these extreme environments. So, and unlike animals, plants are sort of, they're rooted to the spot, they can't run away. So they've got to cop this. So we decided to put our collective expertise together along with the expertise of our colleagues in the Department of Planning, Industry and Environment, the Royal Botanic Gardens Domains Trust and Saving Our Species. So really people who are doing a lot of that, on ground management kind of work, if you like, and conservation work, along with our sort of more fundamental science work at the universities, because we really feel that the sort of much wider, more collaborative space is where we need to be looking at these issues more holistically. The team of scientists at the universities is academics, research assistants, PhD students, honours students, and even, undergraduate interns and volunteers. They're all equal contributors to this work.
Thinking about the work that you're doing and studying these plants and their responses to temperature, what are you looking for? How can you tell a plant is stressed by temperature or has adaptations? What signs are there?
I like to take this back to first principles, if you will. Plants mm-hmm. are essentially the reason humans and indeed most animals exist. There's a whole lot of reasons for that. We've chopped up plants to make shelters and so forth. But the main one, the most obvious one, is carbohydrates, which is our food.
Yes.
And those carbohydrates are produced by photosynthesis, using the energy from sunlight, combined with the water that they're taking up by, through their roots, along with a bunch of soil nutrients. Photosynthesis happens in every part of the plant that is coloured green. So the pigment in plants that makes them green is chlorophyll, and that's where photosynthesis happens. And the proteins involved in photosynthesis are especially sensitive to temperature stress.
Oh.
Yeah. So because photosynthesizing is plants' like main job description, we tend to measure the damage to or the impaired function of these proteins. And that helps us understand plants' response to temperature stress.
That makes so much sense now.
Yes. Well, I tried to make it simple. So we measure that using, there's lots of ways, but generally nowadays most of us doing this work are looking at the stress of this photosynthetic tissue with a tool called a fluorometer, which measures chlorophyll fluorescence. And yeah, it's sort of complex, but just essentially when light hits the chlorophyll, that's a green pigment in the leaves, it travels one of three pathways. It can be used in photosynthesis.
Yep.
It can be dissipated as heat, mm-hmm. or it can be emitted as fluorescence. Now, we don't see that with the naked eye, but it's happening. Actually, fluorescence is happening off everything. But we measure the balance among these three pathways to sort of tell how healthy or damaged the photosystems in the leaves are. And we measure it like before we torture the plants and then after we torture them with some sort of application of temperature stress. And that from that we can determine like a tipping point or threshold, which and that threshold we'll refer to as thermal tolerance of that species at that time.
It's National Tree Day next week, and so I've been thinking a lot more about our tree species and how they differ and how they're the same to other plants and the stresses that they might be encountering. In relation to your project, where do trees fit into the picture?
Yeah, trees are fundamentally important, obviously, in the landscape, and there's a whole lot of reasons for that. I mean, well, plants are generally, but trees, I think one of the particular things is that they're long-lived. They tend to have their roots, you know, well down in the water, water table. They're stabilizing the soil and so on. And so when a tree is lost, it represents, you know, a big loss to the environment because they're long-lived and they take generally and they take a long time to come back, unlike, you know, grass. So understanding how trees survive in the landscape, how they live, how they cope with stress is really important. One of the things that's, I guess, if you think about the stresses I've been talking about, temperature stress in particular, I think it's important to remember that stresses often will come in combination with other stresses. So temperature stress doesn't tend to arrive on its own. Thinking about this mechanistically, you know, if you're a tree in the landscape, and we're thinking about now just high temperatures as an example, one of the best ways to cope with heat extremes is to keep your leaves cool. So if you have access to water, this is often like quite possible. It's a bit like sweating in humans.
Oh.
when you or I get hot, sweat evaporates off the surface of our skin. It works to cool us because water, sweat, it carries heat. And so when the water evaporates off our skin, the heat's lost at the same time, cools us down. So plants don't have sweat glands, but they have stomata on their leaves. And it's through the stomata, when those stomata, their little pores, when they are open, then water evaporates. It actually happens as a byproduct or as a process of photosynthesis. It's not that leaves think, oh, I need to sweat now. It's just a happy sort of like, you know, advantage that when they're evaporating water, it's called transpiration. When transpiration happens and water is evaporating out of their stomata, they're cooling down in the same way that you and I will sweat. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, it's cool. So, but that happens only if stomata are open.
Yes.
So generally speaking, plants can keep their stomata open as long as there's sufficient water in the soil. And also if the, you know, it depends on the species and the triggers and so forth, but if the air isn't really dry and there's enough water in the soil, then they can keep their stomata open and photosynthesis can go on happening. And also leaves can go on cooling. So some of my research team have looked at this in a small desert tree, Myoporum montanum, it's called water bush, in summer when daytime temperatures were reaching the mid-40s, and we found that the difference in leaf temperatures between water-stressed and well-watered plants could be up to several degrees, between 5 and 8 degrees. Yeah, pretty amazing. and that the water stressed leaves were getting up to like 50 degrees, which was
wow.
obviously higher than ambient temperature at the time. And interestingly, we'd also measured thermal thresholds that I was telling you about earlier. Mm. We'd measured those on this plant as well. And so the water stressed leaves were pushing those thermal thresholds, and the unwater stressed plants weren't. So that's, you know, that was really showing how water stress and temperature stress or heat waves were combining. Yeah.
I guess these examples, Andy, am I right in saying, kind of show how many different complex parts of climate change can be challenging for our plant species?
Absolutely, yeah. And that one of the particular, it's not one, but of the factors that are working in concert, extreme events, and will include in that bushfires, mm. flooding, droughts, and temperature events, all of those things are, those extreme events are really what push populations and indeed species over the edge. So you might have a sort of an undercurrent of a low-grade increased average, and people think about, oh, you know, 2 degrees, that's fine, and they just think about the human universe of I can cope with 2 degrees average higher because that feels like nothing. But it's not, it's everything that comes along with that.
100%. What are you hoping is the outcome of this project? Is it to improve just understanding or to apply it to conservation efforts?
Absolutely both. Absolutely both, yeah. And I think that's one of the beauties of having really collaborative teams, is that you're sort of working to a lot of different agendas that are complementary. So one of the arms of the project in the Living on the Edge project, which we're really excited about, is the expert elicitation process, which has been gaining currency more recently because of the need, or the recognition, I suppose, that we have very little time. We have to act quite quickly. We have to make decisions quickly.
Mm.
Science can take a long time.
Yeah.
So there is a need to make some more rapid decisions, and we have a massive lack of data in so many of these areas and on so many species. So what we're doing is trying to approach expert elicitation in such a way that we're gathering the knowledge of experts and attempting and succeeding, I have to please to say, to turn that qualitative knowledge into quantitative data that we can use to inform decision making.
We've talked a few times about the plant's tolerance levels to different temperatures. What is it about plants that makes them more or less tolerant?
Oh, yeah. I wish I had a crystal ball or I wish I knew the answer.
Yeah.
A range of different things, I think. Mm. I mean, we've got a genetic component to our project. At the moment, we're still in the process of collecting those data. The project isn't finished yet. We're sort of two-thirds of the way through. But the next sort of step, or one of the next steps, is working with some of our genetically based colleagues in the Royal Botanic Garden, Sydney, who are helping us to look at whether, if thermal tolerance is changing, for example, thermal tolerance can change based on location. It's a slightly plastic trait. It can change over season, and it can and change, sort of can acclimate, but it can change also based on where it might be situated. So we have that on, we have that going on a more pragmatic level. You know, there are different species that will vary in thermal tolerance, but also we're sort of looking at a bunch of different things. For example, if you've got really thermally tolerant leaves, are they also leaves that are long-lived? Are they also leaves that you will hold on to for several years? Or are you an annual plant that's just going to turn over those leaves every year. Yeah. And it doesn't, you know, that you've got to sort of live fast, die young approach to your leaves. Mm-hmm. And so there have been some recent studies that have looked at that, but some say one thing and some say the other thing. So I think it's a combination of strategies that plants have for this. And and I think one of the things that's fundamentally going to influence how well you can protect your leaves with your physiological mechanisms. When plants are stressed, they produce these things called heat shock proteins. In fact, heat shock proteins exist in all animals, or all living things, I should say. Bacteria, you know, fungi, animals, plants. And there are different ones in different taxa, but heat shock proteins are things that are upregulated when stress is encountered, so not just heat, but potentially drought or other things. And those heat shock proteins set about doing a whole bunch of things, like holding on to proteins to stop them denaturing, falling apart. And that they are fantastic at, you know, preventing death and of leaves, but, you know, protecting photosynthetic tissue, but they're expensive to produce. So if you're going to produce heat shock proteins to look after yourself when you're getting heat stressed, then that might ultimately prevent you from reproducing that year. You might not produce any flowers or fruit. So it's a costly exercise to be protecting your leaves. And so that can also, depending on the plant's strategy, and let's not think about them having brains, but their evolutionary strategy, you know, what they're evolved to do, they might be evolved to protect their leaves and therefore sacrifice fruit, or they might be just letting their leaves get stressed and being prepared to sacrifice those leaves. So, there's a whole range of things that will influence how it changes.
That's fascinating.
I think so.
I'd love to ask Andy, how did you get into this area of research? Because it's so specific.
Here's the short version. I've always been interested in plants, but never really thought particularly that that's something I was interested in. I certainly didn't come into science for a long time. I went to art school, I did a fine arts degree, and then I went to Africa, and then I ended up being a guide in Africa and an overland truck, and I was convinced that I was going to be a zoologist. And so when I finally decided to get serious and come back to Australia and do a science degree, I thought, I'm going to be a zoologist. I love animals so much. But within the first few weeks of my biology degree at ANU, I remember having one of my botany classes, and the teacher, the professor at the time, it was out in the field. He said, come on, our next lesson's going to be up here. And he just dropped everything at the base of this giant fig tree and sort of climbed halfway up the tree within about 2 seconds and said, well, if you want to hear this lecture, you've got to come up here. So we,
goodness.
This is before the days of WHS being an issue. We all climbed up the tree and hung over these fig tree branches, and he gave us a lesson about fig wasp pollination.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, maybe I need to study plants instead. And so I started getting more interested in them. And so I had this real passion for plants by the time I was halfway through my science degree, and I decided that was it. I guess I'm pretty well in love with deserts, partly because I like hot weather and extreme environments and big horizons, but I'm also seriously fascinated with how plants can do it. Like, they just have to sit there and cop it. When, you know, I'm standing there as a human in 47 degrees sort of melting, and they're just going, look, I'm okay, just don't talk to me, I'm just here. and that to me, you know, asking a plant that can't answer, how are you coping?
Yeah.
Is, I guess, partly what drives me.
Absolutely. Oh, that was painted a beautiful picture. And kind of to wrap up from that, do you have any advice for listeners if they're like, wow, I want to learn more and one day contribute to studying either heat tolerant plants or plants affected by climate change. What advice do you have for them to pursue that line of research? What kind of skills do they need to develop?
So if we're talking about listeners who haven't yet gone to uni and thinking about it, then obviously doing a degree in life sciences or environmental sciences is pretty key. You know, stay in science and maths if you can, because it's fun. It's really fun. And even if it feels a bit scary, it was terrifying to me. You know, I was an art student. I grew up like wagging school so that I could, you know, climb trees. But yeah, I think it's stick with it. And then, you know, if you can go to uni, but if you can't go to uni, that's okay too. Volunteer, particularly at places like Botanic Gardens, volunteer for researchers like me. And just get interested, get annoying, be in people's faces so that they can see that you're interested, and just ask lots of questions. And usually asking questions results in more questions, but they'll usually take you somewhere interesting.
Yeah, and that's applicable to any stage of career, whether you're in high school or still at uni, or you know, just someone who's interested in plants. Right, questions will lead you to more questions, but that's good. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning, Andy.
That's been my pleasure, Rose. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Branch Out. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast if you liked it, tell a friend about the podcast, or leave us a review. As promised, next time on Branch Out, we'll be exploring the topic of extreme plants even further, about how the plants and the botanists studying them survive in extreme environments.